Well, as usual, this time of term, it's getting a little sparse in here, so feel free to regroup if you want. You don't have to remain alone. I mean, if you really want to work alone, that's fine, but you can get back into fours if you want. Anyway, there's only one more quiz left in here, and that's because we have only one more regular meeting of new stuff. A little bit less than a week from today, because it's earlier in the day, is when you have your lecture exam, remember, your next one. But that's all we're doing for this course that day, because we don't have a lab meeting next week, because there's a Friday section, and that would be Veterans Day, so to keep them even, we don't have anything in lab. The week after that is when we have our last regular meeting. That's when we do the sense organs. And then another week off for Thanksgiving, and then finally the practicum. And that'll wrap it up, as far as lab is concerned. So today we want to do the brain and cranial nerves. And I think probably for most of you, it'll be more difficult to learn the cranial nerves, or cranial nerve pairs, than it will be to learn the list of brain structures, whether it's on the models or on the sheep brain that you're going to dissect. And probably most of that learning will occur at home, which is appropriate anyway, because I'm not going to go over the cranial nerves in here, and that's because I'm going to go over them in lecture. That's the final part of the current chapter, to wrap up that unit before the test. I'm going over them in lecture because you're going to be responsible for them for the test and for the practicum. I mean, yeah, test and the practicum, and for that matter, the next quiz. By the time we get to the next quiz, though, you'll already have taken your test, so you should just remember the cranial nerves beyond the test. I want to tell you what you really need to know for those, though. It's kind of pointed out in the to-do list, but I want to make it clear. There are 12 cranial nerve pairs. Of course, there's a right and a left version of each one. And every pair has a name, some word. But also every pair has a Roman numeral. So they're ordered 1 through 12 in Roman numerals. You need to know the names and the numbers so that if I give you either of those two, you give me the other. You know, if I say, what's number 4, you need to tell me. If I say, what number is the trochlear nerve, you need to be able to tell me the Roman numeral. So that's two things you need to know about them. You also, though, need to know the kind of information that each pair conveys. And so for each pair, there's three possibilities. Each nerve is either fully sensory, or sensory only, or motor only, or mixed, or both, in other words, both sensory and motor. But I want to tell you, actually, that there's really no such thing as a fully motor cranial nerve, even though we call some of them fully motor. And that's because even in one that we call fully motor, which is whose function it is to send signals to a muscle, for instance, not for instance, that's what they do, a muscle of some type. Even in that case, there are going to be some sensory fibers in that nerve to bring back proprioceptive information, which is sensory, right? So it's not sensory information that's going to lead to your sensation, but it's sensory information so that you make those fine adjustments to make sure you're moving it enough or not too much, like I was talking about in class. So we do call them motor only, or predominantly motor. Predominantly motor is actually correct, because they do have a little sensory. But anyway, you need to know for each of the 12 whether it's motor, sensory, or both. And then you also need to know what major things these nerves connect to, and therefore either get sensory information from or send motor information to. Now, not all the fine details, but the major thing that each one is connected to. Like I said, that's what I'll go over in class, but you can get a head start in looking at those. And it's all often helpful for various things, but especially lists like this, to use some sort of mnemonic to help you remember the string of initials of the names. And there's all kinds of mnemonics available that you can find online. I'll try to remember to post a website for mnemonics, for medical mnemonics that are helpful. You know, there will be several choices that you can make depending on whatever helps you. The one that I learned and still remember actually doesn't apply anymore because they changed the names of a couple of them. But anyway, mnemonics can help for the names. And a separate mnemonic can help you remember the string of letters of M's, B's, and S's for motory, sensory, or both. So that can really help you. Let's talk, though, about the sheep brain, which I need to give you brains once I'm done talking, so remind me to do that before I start passing out quizzes. The sheep brain is pretty easy dissection, really. Let me go to Udo's website to take a look at what we're looking at. We have black and white diagrams that are useful also, but if you want to follow along at Udo's site while you're doing the dissection, that can be helpful too. But whether you use it here while you're doing the dissection or just at home, you should definitely use this site to study with. Anyway, the dissection is kind of nice for a couple reasons. One is that even though these are sheep brains and this is a human anatomy course, sheep brains are good to use because they are just a miniature model of the human brain. In other words, they have all the same structures that the human brain does and they're about in the right proportions. So it's just like the whole thing got shrunk and everything got shrunk equally. There is one difference, though, and I addressed this in lecture. In a sheep brain, the brain stem and then the spinal cord that comes from this or extends from this brain stem comes out the back, right? Because the spinal cord is horizontal in a sheep. So the big difference here between our brain, other than the size, our brain and the sheep brain, is that the brain stem and the spinal cord are rotated because we're bipedal. But other than that, it looks like a human brain does, just not quite as big. Keep in mind when you look at that, though, that the models here are about the right size for a human brain. When you look at your sheep brain, consider the fact that a sheep and a human are about the same size. But the brain is much different. Now, you probably already knew that humans are smarter than sheep, but that shows you. Anyway, each brain will be a little bit different. But that's another nice thing, and the differences are really small compared to other organs that I would give you from a sheep, for instance, that would look more drastically different from individual to individual. The brains are all very, very similar, so you should be able to see almost exactly what these pictures picture in your real one. And when you compare each other's, if you do, they should look very similar. Some of you might have more than others, though. There's probably some stuff on there that is just tissue you can get rid of that's not part of your things you need to know. If you have any doubt about whether you're allowed to tear it off or whether it's something you need to know, ask me. But there's some stuff that connected to the meninges that just are basically connection points to the skull that you can get rid of. Most of these brains, in fact, all of them should have at least some of the meninges on them still, maybe completely. Remember, there are three meninges. Well, when you cut the meninges, cut this covering and fold it away from the brain, that's really two of the three. The outer surface of that tough covering is the dura mater. But when you fold that over, you're dragging the arachnoid mater with it. So the arachnoid mater, just think of as the inner surface of that major flap that covers the whole brain. The pia mater, you don't actually remove. You won't be able to remove it. It's just the glistening surface of the brain itself. That pia mater is right there on that surface. So don't even try to remove that. Once you see what the meninges look like, you feel free to cut them away. or at least to zip it open so that you can fold them away, if not remove them entirely. You'll eventually cut this thing, but before you do any cutting, it's good to look at it from all angles just to see what you can see without cutting it. But go ahead and remove the meninges from at least the top of the brain so that you can see the longitudinal fissure and the various lobes, plus the cerebellum. And while you're at it, once the meninges are removed from the top, grab it and pull the cerebellum down with respect to the cerebrum, which will be easy to do because they're not connected to each other. There's a big crack between them. So we're looking at it in median view here. Before you do the cut, though, pull the cerebellum away from the cerebrum to look right here, and you'll get a good view of the four bumps that are the corpora quadrigemina. You see labeled here? Before you cut it, you'll get a really good view of the four round lumps. So it's two rows of two, right? What are those top two called? Superior colliculi is the plural. Colliculus is one of them. And the two on the bottom are the inferior colliculi. Together, they all make up the corpora quadrigemina. So that's something you should look at before you cut it. Now, you can cut it any way you want it, but you should try to make one mid-sagittal or median cut, which means right down the middle if you can, using that longitudinal fissure as a guide. And if you do it really well, get right at the center, then you should be able to see on one of those halves the septum pellucidum I was talking about today that separates the two lateral ventricles. But that's just, you should do that if only because then you'll be looking at something that matches these photographs. So that's a good section to make. And then after you look at that for a while and find stuff, you can also make a coronal plane, a coronal section, so that you can look at the front piece and the back piece. That also matches pictures here. So cerebellum and dual oblongata and then spinal cord, that's all pretty obvious stuff. If you look at it from below, you might have the pituitary gland there on your brain, but maybe it was ripped away. It's easy to rip away if you take the meninges completely off. The pituitary will go with it, which is no problem as long as you look at it before to see where it is and to see how big it is and whatnot. There's some trash tissue that's right around it, too, that you really don't have to care about, but the pituitary is right there in this position. And if you do tear it away, which is easy to do, it's like picking a grape, you'll see the connection point that it used to be connected to. What is that point called? That structure that leads from the hypothalamus to the pituitary? I was talking about this in lecture today. The funnel-shaped thing? Infundibulum. And so after it's removed, you might see like the tip of the funnel, just a round structure with a hole in it, basically, is the infundibulum. The optic chiasm here, what does chiasm mean? It means cross, right. Same word as we use for crossing over genetically. So the optic nerves, which of course are coming from the eyeballs, one for each eyeball, cross each other before they reach the brain, and that optic chiasm is just a crossover point. So if my fingertips are the eyeballs and then they come to a cross, that crossover point, like I said, is the optic chiasm. Everything between the eyeball and the optic chiasm is properly called an optic nerve because that's part of the peripheral nervous system. But after the chiasm, it's officially part of the central nervous system. And therefore, the bottom part after the chiasm, between the chiasm and the rest of the brain, those legs are called the optic tracts because now they're in the central nervous system. And similarly with the olfactory nerves. The neurons that make up the olfactory nerves are housed in an enlargement called an olfactory bulb. And there's one on either side. Those are easy to see on the bottom surface of the brain. They'll be yellowish or whitish. And the bulbous end looks kind of like the end of a cotton swab. That cotton part, the bulbous part, is where the optic nerve is. When it gets slender and then leads like a ribbon to the rest of the brain, that's a collection of other neurons that are connected to that optic nerve, those optic nerves, that optic nerve, and therefore that ribbon-like part is part of the central nervous system. That's the olfactory tract. Did I say optic a little bit? Yeah. I meant olfactory the whole time there. So just the bulb is the olfactory nerve. The ribbon is the olfactory tract. That's easy to spot, though, once you get the meninges out of the way. And then the pons is easy to spot as just a bulge. The medulla oblongata itself is a bulge, but it's a separate bulge, and then you get to the spinal cord. And when you're, after you've looked at all that stuff without making a cut, you can finally make your mid-sagittal cut. That gives you a very good view of the corpus callosum, which is very conspicuous because of its shape and its color. It looks like a rubber band, except that when it curves back around, it's no longer the corpus callosum, it's the fornix. And the fornix is part of the limbic system that I was showing you in blue today, with the amygdala and the hippocampus. In most brains, the corpus callosum and fornix aren't straight like this, but they're more curved, which makes sense because fornix means arch, and it arches over the thalamus that's right here. All right. But anyway, the reason I said try to make it as median as possible, right in the middle, because if you do, then on one half of your brain, but only one half, you'll see between the corpus callosum and the fornix a membrane, and that membrane is the septum pellucidum. On the other half, you should see just a space, which is one of the lateral ventricles, depending on which side it's on. The other lateral ventricle is on the other side of this membrane, which you could easily pierce through if you wanted to. But the septum pellucidum separates the two ventricles. Okay? The thalamus itself is about the same color as things around it, but you can see at least a faint outline of its roundness when you do your dissection. And so that's one half of the thalamus. The other half is on the part that was removed. And this little circle right in the middle of the circle, remember what that's called, the thing that holds the two halves of the thalamus together? Interthalamic adhesion, correct. That's like the axle of the yo-yo that you wind the string around. Well, the space, not the white stuff, but the space immediately in front of this white stuff would really be the middle of the yo-yo, because the other half of the thalamus would be here. And so that space is the third ventricle. And then the third ventricle leads to the cerebral aqueduct. And then finally to the fourth ventricle, which I said always look for the fourth ventricle between the cerebellum and the pons. There should be a little bit of a widening on most brains. Fourth ventricle is right here, and then that leads to the central canal of the spinal cord. So those are all spaces. See a view of the pituitary gland here. But the rest, I think, I've talked about. And when you finally do a frontal or coronal section, you'll get this view. No new structures here, but a different view of them. This just gives you a good view of the fact that the corpus callosum is what kind of structure, since it's connecting both halves. What is the corpus callosum? It's a commissure, exactly. Commissures are places where decussation occurs. And the major cerebral commissure is the corpus callosum. So that's it. Make sure you look at the models, too, and take pictures, as usual. But don't forget about the cranial nerves.